Okay, we're going to move to the beginning of an application of the roadmap now. And first, before we begin specific applications that we'll do for money, relationships, wellness, and that sort of thing, I want to talk about something that I think is a crucial aspect for success and a crucial aspect just in our day-to-day living. I want to introduce it by asking you to imagine something with me. Imagine that you're at an auction and the room is filled with 75 sophisticated-looking people in business attire. The auctioneer holds a $100 bill before the group, and he explains the auction scenario. Bids move in $5 increments. The highest bidder wins the bill. The second highest bidder pays the bid but gets nothing in return. And he reminded the group, this is real money. Within seconds, the bids pass $100. Some of the 75 people push the bidding up to $300. Two of the people get in a bidding war. One of them ends up paying $465 for the $100 bill. The other writes a check for $460 and gets nothing. Now, that seems kind of dumbfounding. How could reasonable people pay more for something than it's worth? It's clearly a $100 bill. Well, this scenario has actually happened. It's happened more than 600 times. The auctioneer, Professor Max Bazerman. The setting, Harvard's JFK School of Government. The participants, not undergraduates, not people off the street, investment specialists and economic gurus, some of the brightest financial experts, consistently pay 3 to 4 times the worth of the $100 bill just because of the way their minds work. And now, this isn't a stock whose perceived value is determined only by the bid. This is clearly a $100 bill. Professor Bazerman commented, I've never seen bidding stop below $100 in any of the 600 times that I've done it. So what happened here? What mind matters and brain business secrets are hiding in the open? Well, here's some of what we know. There's some contributions from the mind. Loss aversion. I'm not going to be the second highest bidder, still pay and get nothing. Studies show that losing $100 makes you twice as unhappy as gaining $100 makes you happy. Sunk cost fallacy. Well, I've already bid $260. I'll just go $10 higher. That way of segmenting things looks only at the increment. I've sat on boards of directors where this kind of thinking begins to take shape. And I inevitably comment because this segmentation is, well, we're just considering $10 more here or whatever the figure is. No, it's the entire figure that you're considering. The increment is what you're adding. And sometimes we justify continuing because of what we've already put into something. So here's some contributions from the brain. The prefrontal cortex says, I'm going to stop at $95. The limbic system says, well, I'm excited. I'm going to win. I can't stop now. Our states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. In that auction room, brains were on an emotional contagion, and emotions and states of mind are highly contagious. In that room, herd mentality was running wild. But now here's the conversation without that contagion. Prefrontal cortex says, let's save for retirement. The limbic system said, nah, I'm going to have that second cognac and I'm going to order the 27-inch iMac. Now, money behaviors and financial decisions are sometimes, rarely, actually about money. If money were about math, no one would have personal debt and they would spend only what they make. And $100 would be $100 instead of another number based on another state of mind. Now, here's one more brief scenario to give you an idea of contagion. 433 people voted on a proposal. It failed. If only 12 of those 433 people had voted yes instead of no, the outcome would have been exactly the opposite. The result? In the next 5 hours, the stock market lost $1.2 trillion. Here's what one senior equity trader on Wall Street said. You just felt like the world was unraveling. People started to sell and they sold hard. It didn't matter what you had, you sold. This contagion shows how states of mind are vulnerable. This was the vote on the mortgage bailout in late 2008 that crystallized an entire economic scenario of events, some of which we have just recovered from. Chuck Prince, then head of Citigroup, a lead financial institution, said, "As long as the music is playing, it feels like you've got to get up and dance." So sometimes greed, emotional contagion, peer pressure, trump logic. And this is about states of mind. People aren't stupid. They're just not regulated. They make mistakes. They buy low and sell high, either because they don't have a plan or they don't stick to them. When emotion vaults beyond the fence of that plan, even when they're finance or economic experts, they pay $350 for a $100 bill. And I know two buddies who were in one of those auctions. Both of them came up to me after a keynote I did and said, "Dave, that was exactly how it went down." Neither one of them would admit to what their bids were. So these are some things to consider then about regulating states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. A state of mind then is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. A key element in mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of different states of mind with particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. For example, writing and editing, two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain. Here's an illustration, and I want to make this more practical, but I want to give you kind of a stark illustration here of how states of mind are like different software packages. If you take a rat and put it in a maze and teach it to go to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if before you teach the rat to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, you simulate a mild stress-like condition. You teach the rat to go to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you take that amphetamine away, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can, in that maze, literally die of starvation because it can't access the information in the part of its brain to get to the cheese. Re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-specific memory. So a model of how state of mind and regulation of states, another kind of bold example, is the infant child, infant adult, the infant adult interaction. In any moment, an infant is totally in a particular state. Upset, hunger, contentment, happy, pain. The adult resonates with the state in order to lend the function of regulation until the infant's soothed. So as time the infants develop, they learn to internalize this process. So they moderate, they regulate these states ultimately more and more themselves to internally regulate, to ultimately self-regulate entirely. This is something that at times we may do in coaching. So we know how important this is. So I want to talk a little bit about how this may look in coaching and give you some examples of that. A state of mind, as I mentioned, is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. So a key element of mastery is to become aware of different states of mind and pay particular attention to what state works best. So here's an example of a kind of regulation. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage. They were lowest in their division nationwide, 217 out of 217, when he took over. So during practice, he had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. Now, a mantra is three parts. A cue, some physical cue to begin the process. And Reed suggested bouncing the ball twice before shooting. And the second part is focus, a three- or four-word phrase just to focus attention and energy for the success of the task. The example that he illustrated was relaxed and smooth, but he emphasized that they developed their own phrase because that just focuses attention. And the third part is physiology. So the cue initiates the focus and the physiology. For the physiology, he suggested one deep breath in and one deep breath out. And so every time they practiced, whenever they would shoot, they would dribble twice, do their focus phrase, their deep breath, and shoot. Within 2 years, their team was ranked number one in their division nationwide. So these are the thoughts about using a mantra, to focus on the target, not the mechanisms, to visualize successful completion, and even to practice performing under pressure. Now, I sent around to each of you a neural conditioning chart. I'd like you to refer to that if you have access to it. If you don't, it's just four columns. First column is emotional trigger. You can write it down if you don't have access to a computer. Four vertical columns. First column is emotional trigger. The next column, usual response or behavior. The third column is the mantra. Cue, focus, and physiology. And the fourth column is ideal response or behavior. Now, look at that as I tell you how I initially developed that, because it kind of is a way to walk through that. I initially created this chart to help an executive woman who was very successful in her personal and professional life, with one exception. Once a year, when she went home to visit her family of origin, she could routinely do okay for several hours to almost a day. And she would have a resolve. I'm not going to get into the arguments and the fits with my family that has happened every year at a major holiday ever since I can remember. But she could hold together for several hours, at times the better part of the day, but then her resilience and resolve would wear down. And as she said, she would just lose it. She would get in arguments, angry exchanges with both parents and her brother and sister. And I first asked her, what is your age when you have those conversations? In other words, how old do you feel inside? She immediately said, well, it's like I'm a teenager again. I instantly feel and act like I'm 13 and 14. And, of course, that continued, so it kept being that age. So we discussed what emotional triggers she was aware of, and she mentioned several. The way her dad would roll his eyes at her, an annoying phrase her mom would use, teasing by her brother. So I recommended this, that she set aside at least 30 minutes of uninterrupted time as an appointment with herself, and then to get very centered and grounded as she would reflect on writing down all the triggers that she was aware of, all those emotional triggers that wouldn't instantly set her off. And I emphasize to do this as an observer, not to reenter those states, to not let the triggers be triggering, but just to observe what those were and write down every one that she could think of, maintaining her very grounded and centered state so that she could be very mindful of this. And for each trigger, to write then what her usual behavior or response was. And that's all for the first session. And she did that. She said she was amazed at how much she came to see. And I said, let's do the second step now. Create the same time, a brainstorming time with yourself, to look at developing a mantra. And I explained the three parts, just as I did with you. And I said, you may want to create something, you know, she's not going to carry a basketball around, but may want to develop something that is totally unobservable by anybody else. And I shared mine with her. When I get ready to do a keynote, when I get ready for some major happening, I will put my index finger and thumb together on both hands, and my focus phrase for like a keynote is relaxed and powerful. And I'll take two deep breaths in, breathe in relaxation, breathe out tension. So in 5 to 6 seconds, I'm ready to go. What she did was to decide to touch her ring. She had a ring on her right hand that was very special to her, and she could touch that ring without anybody being aware. And that would then cue her to use her focus phrase, and she developed her own focus phrase and a couple of deep breaths. And I urged her to practice doing this, to do this several times a day, because ultimately what she would notice, and I shared this later rather than up front, I didn't want to give her too much, what she would notice is that this itself would rewire her brain, that simply the cue alone would be enough to create that grounded and centered experience, because that being grounded and centered was the initial step to pre-planning to enter the ideal behavior that was pre-planned, so that whenever she was in that situation, whenever she noticed an emotional trigger, she would already have cued her radar to recognize it and recognize what her usual response was, and instead get grounded and centered rather than getting lost in that altered state, and then moving into an ideal response. So that ultimately, over time, but not for the first major holiday, but over time, the old emotional trigger will cue the ideal response, because the brain is rewired to do that because it's being done over and over again. But at least she had this neuroconditioning chart. She had this chart to work on, to be aware of the usual emotional triggers and what her usual response was, and instead to get grounded and centered and move to an ideal response. It was pre-planned. It wasn't something she had to think of at the time. And I emphasize, you may need to do this. You may need to do your mantra several times. And remember, too, you have an unlimited number of timeouts. This is not the NBA. You can call a timeout anytime. If you're at dinner and you feel that this is something that you're aware of, you can always excuse yourself and go to the bathroom. You can splash cold water in your face, or you can walk outside. Regulate yourself in every way. This is an internal way. At times, especially initially, you may need to do something more, and you may need to do this several times and do it even when you don't need to. She came back and reported that this was the absolute best major holiday, it was a Thanksgiving, that she had ever had. And she had some, recognized that she had some additional things to work on, that it wasn't easy, but that she had a new system. So I've refined this over time, but it really, I believe, works amazingly well. The reason I sent you that page as an attachment is if you want to use it for yourself or for clients, that you're certainly welcome to do that, and I'd be interested in your thoughts if you decide to use it in that way. So this is about immediately regulating a state of mind, and then being able to choose a state of mind that fits a task that you want it to. Now, if we look at the other broader system, the roadmap system, any emotional trigger can create an instantaneous state change. And awareness of the process allows the ability to regulate and choose your response to any triggering event, whether it's internal or external. And remember, it's not the event. It's our response to an event that initiates a state change. And that very thin line between column one and column two, that's an instantaneous change of state of mind. You boot up a different state that, like in the example of the woman I mentioned, that's like a time capsule. And the content of that time capsule, that emotional overwhelm, or it can simply be a time capsule that's negative self-talk. I don't think I'll do it. I don't think I have what it takes. You know, I'm not good enough. It can be, the content of that state can be from your right brain, the emotional overwhelm, or your left brain, and get marooned there, and that's the negative thought loops. So the idea is to recognize that as quickly as possible, to cue your radar to recognize it, to then immediately move into regulating your state, getting grounded and centered, and choosing the ideal response from a grounded and centered state. You can't move from column two to column four. You can't move from that altered state to an ideal response. That's why people get stuck in therapy, because when you're in that state and trying to figure it out or work it through or create a better solution, 1,000 better endings later, you've recreated the old story again and again. Every time you re-enter that state, it grooves it, it etches it a little bit further in your brain. We now know from neuroscience. So getting in that state, trying to figure it out, trying to work it through, have catharsis, you know, express all the feelings from it, it only etches it further. And that's why people get stuck. And that's why being in that state is not helpful to work within that state, but to get grounded and centered. That's the first step, and then to move to an ideal state. What that does is create new neuronal networks and a new system in your brain. And the more you do it, the more automatic and ultimately default mode it will become. So that's the process that you can do and move across for each of the triggers to move across that neural conditioning chart. So you can become conscious. You can direct your choices. Self-awareness is the first step to transform thought and feelings and your state of mind, the specific choice of software program that you operate on. So other events and people will trigger unwanted thoughts or unpleasant feelings, but they do not cause them. Much of how you respond operates unconsciously from the beliefs and automatic couplings in your mind and brain. Pleasant emotions, happiness, joy, confidence, are coupled with a healthy body state. Unpleasant emotions cue stress hormones and neurochemicals. So it's vital to learn to empathically understand your full range of feelings and thoughts that cue those behaviors as quickly as possible in that response cycle, so that you can choose to respond differently, that you can choose how you respond. Now, you can also roadmap this system. I know I'm superimposing another system here, and I don't want to be confusing, but this is an awareness of feelings and their connection to your thoughts and how they relate to choices. So in this process, you own your present awareness and any state changes that you have. That's a kind of an overarching assumption of doing the neural conditioning chart, that an emotional trigger, that emotional trigger is always going to be there. You're not going to change that. All you can change is how you respond to it. So you assess the emotions and feelings, the automatic behavior that results from the emotional trigger. Be aware of the feelings, the sensations in your body. Be aware of what you experience at this moment. So that awareness allows you to, instead of staying in it and trying to figure it out within it and being aware of, you know, some significant significant time later, you can more immediately, more quickly recognize it to get grounded and centered. So then you decide what predetermined strategy you use, because you have already determined what an ideal behavior or response would be to that trigger. And you just engage it. You don't have to do two steps at once. In that sense, you have already pre-planned and you engage it. You map an ideal response, that fourth column in the neural conditioning chart, instead of the emotional trigger coupled with usual automatic response, you have an ideal response that you have already mapped out, and you choose that after regulating your state of mind so that you author new experiences. You complete an ideal behavior and the thoughts and the feelings that match that response, and then program a new identity. When you recognize you have choices, that the past behaviors don't define your identity, you incorporate this new model into a present identity. The mastery and confidence of effectively making informed choices. And this identity is within a growth mindset, so that basically you have evolved the fundamental model of who you are, and it incorporates the change and the transformation that you've made in responding differently in emotional situations. So this is a huge change of something that's as fundamental as identity. I'm gonna stop earlier than I would ordinarily, because I want to be sure that we talk about this and that you have a sense of understanding of this. Let me give one more example about self-regulation from a client. I worked with a guy, a professional. He was a moderately successful CPA who functioned brilliantly when he focused and became immersed on a specific task. But his challenge was twofold. If there were any external distractions, he got derailed, and he had trouble moving from task to task, project to project during the day. So I mean, he had a form of attention deficit or attention challenge, so that it was a challenge for him if there was any kind of distraction. So what we did in terms of states of mind is to recognize what state worked best for him. His brilliance came when he worked at his computer and created some novel solutions for situations. And when he focused on his work at the computer, he did great. But he was in a firm. His other goal, he owned the firm, and his other goal was to take his firm to be a regional presence instead of just a local presence. So we looked at his functioning first as a first order of business. So for him, self-regulation involved establishing an entire daily schedule so that he had a map for the day and he could readily look at where he was, because he would allow other people, telephone calls, various things to interrupt him. And every time he was interrupted, it took three times as much energy because he was very immersed in something, and then suddenly he had to switch his energy, get immersed in that task. If somebody who worked for him did a curbside consult or sought his advice, or there was a telephone call and he had to switch to that state entirely, then when he got back to his work, he had to change back to that state. So it was a good deal of work. It took a lot of energy, and he was less than optimally effective. So what we did was look at his daily schedule. This is sort of, you know, very practical, but it's management of states of mind. To schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to sustain his state of mind. In other words, when he did his primary best work on the computer, we schedule that as two uninterrupted times during the day. And his assistant knew not to put through calls, not to interrupt him, and there was nothing that interrupted that. She scheduled all calls that he would do for a particular 45-minute period of the day at the end of the day, because his optimum biorhythm of most creative time when he was on, that was in the morning. So both of these times uninterrupted clustered in the morning. She scheduled times for people to consult with him, would intercept them and schedule them for a particular time after noon. So when he was at the computer, he would write out his daily schedule. And this is something that I suggested that he try. His entire daily schedule on a larger post-it note to the left of his computer. And to the right, he would put on a smaller post-it note his next best action, what he was going to do this hour. So at any point, he had a map of the day, and he had a focus for this hour of what he would do and what he would be immersed in. So those were factors that immensely enhanced his productivity, because he learned to manage states of mind, and it became as easy as anyone who was wired differently without those attention problems, because once he could focus, he had even better attention than someone who didn't have his particular wiring. So this was immensely useful for him, and it was an optimum way of using his energy. So this was important. There's also I don't have this in the outline, but there is a book that a neuroscientist at Harvard, he's a neuropsychiatrist, and he's become a buddy. We've talked about a number of things. And he was a guest recently for my the mentor group that I do, that each of you will be invited to on a quarterly basis. His name is Dr. Sarini, S-R-I-N-I, Pillay, P-I-L-L-A-Y. His book, that I would recommend this book, is called Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try. It's a goofy title, but what he's found is that when we take an active role in regulating our states of mind by, for example, having a period of unfocus, a time like, and the best research shows, for example, for most people, that for each hour when they immerse themselves in focused work, that it's beneficial to have a 5 to 10 minute time built in for unfocus, for refueling, to meditate, to take a walk. To take a walk in nature was the best refueling in a cross section of a number of people. That this offers the best possibility of optimally using that time and the best resultant concentration and focus when they take a break. And that unfocus, that break time, is not for doing emails or doing text, but for a total unfocus that allows a kind of timeout for the whole energy system of the brain. So those are some things that if you look at that book, if you decide to get it, I think you'd find it really beneficial in a number of ways. He's a great thinker, and he compiles research in an exemplary way for application. So I want to stop here, and I'll get us off